Great. Well, it's good to see everyone and to see a bunch of familiar names. Actually, this is my first Adoma remote Adoma meeting, so this is really cool. Good to see those of you who are present, whether I can see your faces or not. And I hope you're all doing well and your families are all hanging in there and everyone's moving forward. Like you all, our firm really had to pivot early this year. Just for those of you who don't know who I am, I'm Smithson.
Jennifer, you're fading in and out. No, Jennifer, we lost you. No. All right.
Auto dealers.
Jennifer, you kind of went away, so nobody heard anything you just said.
Specializes.
Oh, now Jennifer's gone. All right. Computer technology. I just love it. Okay, she's calling back in. Jennifer? All right. Well, she tried to call back in. Did we lose her? Jennifer? There. Jennifer? All right. Well, we lost Jennifer. So I guess we'll just start the meeting with Lewis, and then if Jennifer comes back on, we'll give her a little bit of time at the end. Are you okay with that, Lewis?
Yeah, that's perfect. In fact, I'll wrap up a little early, and then Jennifer can have she can have as much time as she likes there towards the end, because I have not eaten dinner, so I am very hungry.
Oh, okay.
So that may encourage me to talk faster.
Okay,
so let's get started. Let me get the sharing here.
It looks like Jennifer came back. So Jennifer, if you can hear me, for some reason you went away. We didn't hear anything you said. So we're just going to go into the presentation and give you your 5 minutes after.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Let's get started. So we're going to talk about PPP loans. We're going to talk about forgiveness. We're going to just kind of walk through some of the nuances and look at some of the frequently asked questions from the SBA. And so this is going to be a pretty quick run through. We're going to go through a lot of information. But what I would say is that we'll leave the slide deck with you. You'll have the slide deck. I'll leave the FAQs as well. So if you want to go back through this, you can. And if you have additional questions, we can walk through some of those tonight. And then if you have additional questions, you can obviously email me as well. I'm happy to field some questions. I guess what I would say is just, kind of at the outset is that as we all know, this came to be earlier this year when we thought life as we knew it was about to end. And so the world has changed significantly from the economic uncertainty that we all felt back in March to the record profitability that many of us are experiencing as we move into the latter half of 2020. So it has been just a completely unusual set of events. Check Protection Program that was rolled out with little guidance. It was rolled out with a ton of questions. As we've gone over time, some of those questions have been answered, but there's still ambiguity in some of these areas. And so you'll see that as we go through a couple of these slides where there's still ambiguity, we'll highlight that. But I, you know, what I would say is the way this has come to pass, the SBA has made this program almost impossible for you not to get full forgiveness of your loans. They have re-engineered it. They've created new rules. They've created updates that if you follow, you should be able to achieve full forgiveness. And so we'll walk through some of the examples of that and why that is. And if you have questions about that, we can answer that as well. So, you know, just again, the purpose of the loan was, you know, to basically pay for payroll for 8 weeks to get through what we thought was going to be a 2 month period of, a 2 month period of life, which clearly was not how reality occurred. So, there were several, there may be some of you on this call that if you took out a loan early on that you played by the rules and you fully paid everybody for 8 weeks. There are quite a few of you who didn't do that and let the business rule. And instead of doing that, you paid for the people that were on staff and you saved the money for a later day and are utilizing those funds now. And so for those of you that followed the original rules for the 8 weeks, unfortunately, you didn't get the most benefit out of this program. For those of you that have taken a longer approach, you're getting a bigger benefit. And the reason for that is if you paid unproductive labor during the 8 week period versus a company that did not do that and didn't bring everybody back and let people go onto unemployment, you essentially subsidize the state's unemployment program with your Paycheck Protection Program loan. Whereas dealerships that didn't do that are able to use those funds for productive labor. And so there's inequities in this program when you think about it from that standpoint. But unfortunately, it kind of is what it is. I just wanted to throw some stats. This is as of June, so it's a little bit dated now, as of June 30th. But it just gives you an idea of the total number of loans, the number of lenders, which I think is interesting. As you can see, over 5,400 lenders have issued PPP loans. And at June 30th, the net dollars that was distributed was $521 billion. You can see below there the lender size, just to give you an idea of who the lenders were that were making these loans. And I'm sure there may be some people on this call that found out if you were working with Wells Fargo or Bank of America or some of the larger banks, that they were not as receptive as the smaller banks were. And so you can see that the lender size, those with less than $10 billion in assets, issued the vast majority of these loans. And so it was interesting how this has played out, whereas going into it, it was assumed that Wells Fargo would be the king because they're the SBA leader. And unfortunately, they were not suited to handle this program quite as advertised. Give you an idea of what the loan size looks like, just to so you can kind of compare as to what your loan looks like versus what the majority of loans issued was. You can see where you fall into this chart. You know, from a dealership standpoint, I would say the majority of loans that we have seen and with our clients that we've interacted with, and a half to some, we've seen some over $5 million. You can see from the percentages here, clearly that's the minority of the loans that were issued. And so when you look at the count, and then more importantly, go over to the right and look at the percentage of the count, that greater than a million is a pretty small percentage from a count standpoint. From a dollar amount standpoint, it's not as skewed, but the actual number of loans that were issued over that $1 million mark is small. If we go to the $2 million mark, which is really important, and we'll talk about that in a few slides ahead, which you probably already aware of, but from the safe harbor rule, if you want to call it that, where they have talked about that the loans under $2 million won't be subject to audit, you can see that the loans over $2 million, it's only 0.6% of the total loans issued are over $2 million. So you can kind of, in this slide, I think makes it clear as to why they used $2 million as a bright line to determine which ones they would audit specifically and which ones they would let the banks process. So this, I think, not to scare anybody, but I think this helps put it into perspective as to the scrutiny that we in the automotive industry are probably going to experience from the SBA. We're going to see a level of scrutiny that others may not, just because most of our loans fall into these larger categories. Just an idea by sector, just to understand where the loan balances fall. You can see that you can see healthcare and social assistance from a net dollar standpoint is the highest balance, and you can go down below as this is sorted by net dollars, not the number of loans, just to give an idea as to where the money went. Okay, so what I want to do is I'm going to spend time talking about what the recent updates are, just to kind of go through what's latest. And the reason why is because there has been so much information that has come out that it seems like a lot of the rules and a lot of the guidance has evolved. And so, with that in mind, what I want to do is I want to make sure that you're aware of the resources that are available on the SBA website. So you can look on the SBA website and see the frequently asked questions that they continue to issue. The most recent would be August 4th. And those are a PDF, that's a PDF doc that comes from the SBA website. We're going to look at that as well. But just kind of keep it in mind that there's different iterations of this process. And so it definitely has evolved. And if you feel like you've gotten contradicting, responses, or you've received different answers, it largely could be just because the SBA has changed their opinion over time and they've changed the rules over time. So that could be it. It could also be because the person you're asking has absolutely no idea what they're talking about, which unfortunately, because we've all had to learn on the fly as this program has come out, there's been a lot of people with opinions but that may not be based in fact. So I think that's also part of the challenge that we've seen. But on here, just kind of highlighting some of the recent guidance, the Flexibility Act. This was what was signed into law on June 5th. And this was really the tipping point that took this program and put it into the space where I made the comment that they've almost made it impossible for you not to achieve forgiveness and full forgiveness at that. This Flexibility Act was the mechanism that did this. This was important because up to this point, many of you may have been having this conversation, but that idea of economic uncertainty and the certification and should we keep the loans, that was a really big question. And up to this point, we really weren't sure because the winds were kind of blowing in a certain direction where there were certain senators who were seeming to indicate that they wanted to apply scrutiny to this. And then there were others that said no. And clearly the way this drifted was in the court towards those who did not want additional scrutiny and they wanted this economic stimulus. So you had like Senator Marco Rubio, who really was very vocal that the intent of this program was for this to be a grant. And that's a word that I just kind of want to plant in the back of your head, is that idea of a grant. Because a government grant is a double-edged sword. A grant is good because it gives you money, it grants you money, it allows you cash flow that you have access to and that you don't have to repay. The other side of that sword, though, is it is a government grant. So anything the government grants, the government can also take. And the way the government takes is typically not in the same way that it gave. And so by taking a grant, you are giving yourself over to the government to allow scrutiny, to allow questions, to allow inquiry over that grant that they've given you. And so what's important about that, that's included in this Flexibility Act, is a provision that allows the SBA to come back and review at the request of the Senate or the House. They could come back and review loans for a 5-year period. And so why that 5-year period is important is because from a political standpoint, it was inserted in there to ensure that no matter who the next administration is, that you would have a look back period that would extend into the subsequent administration. So even if you were to have another 4 years for the Trump administration, the administration after them could then come back and take another look at some of these loans if they so chose. So at this point of the game, it is what it is. Everybody's taking the money. You're going to seek forgiveness most likely. But it is important to remember that just because you seek forgiveness, you go through that process and are granted forgiveness, the government could always come back and they could relook at this. They could also attach retroactive requirements to you as a company because you took a government grant. So again, what the government gives, the government can take, and it's just important to keep that in mind. So just looking at some of the additional highlights here that was included in this Flexibility Act that maybe that you're aware of, we're going to talk about the 8 weeks versus 24 week for your covered period. There's more clarity now on the application for forgiveness in theory, but I'm assuming most of you have found out that the lenders you've taken loans with are not accepting forgiveness applications. The systems aren't up yet. The portals aren't up yet. And some of you are eager to apply for forgiveness, but that process by and large hasn't started yet. And so we'll talk about why that's not as big of a deal as it might seem. Also keeping in mind that idea of a government grant, it all kind of goes together. So we'll talk a little bit about that. The updated payroll cost percentage split. If you recall from the beginning, you had to spend 75% of the funds on payroll costs. Now you're only required to spend 60%. Really important piece of the updates was the full-time equivalent rehire guidelines. We'll look at some of that as well. Originally it seemed very draconian. You had to maintain a certain level of staffing. You had to bring people back. And then we found out that, who would have thought when the government pays people to stay home and they make more money staying home, they don't want to come back to work. Everybody was shocked. And so the government decided to give us a solution for that. And that was included in the Flexibility Act. Updates to the application deadlines, the loan repayment terms, the maturity dates, payroll tax deferral eligibility. That's an important piece. Not for us, because most of us in the dealership space have plenty of cash, but there is an option there that now exists along with PPP loans that allows you to defer payroll taxes. We'll look at that as well. And then the last thing that's the last couple of bullet points here, clarification on payroll costs for owner employees. For us, that's typically only going to be one or two people at our dealerships, but there was confusion around that as to how you included monies related to them. And so there's some clarifications that are also included in these August 4th FAQs that I'm going to point you to as well that you could look at. And then last, the Form 3508, 3508EZ, they created an easy application, which if you meet certain requirements, you don't have to provide as much payroll data at the time you submit your application. Most dealerships are not going to be eligible for that. I haven't had any that are, just because as an industry, we typically did not retain all of our employees during the period that we'd look at. But if you did, there are some nuances there that could make it easier for you to apply. So let's talk about the covered period. And when we talk about the covered period, we're talking about that time period between when the loan was funded, meaning the money came into the account, not the day you applied, but the day that the money was received, that starts the clock. And so originally that was our 8 week period. But with the Flexibility Act, now we have the option for 24 weeks. So if you received a loan before June 5th, which I'm assuming most everybody on this call did, you default now into the 24-week period unless you elect to keep the 8-week covered period. So you still have the option to look at that 8-week period. The safe harbor that they created about restoring full-time equivalents originally was penciled in June. It now is extended to December 31st. So in theory, if you kept the loan you could ride this out until December 31st and you could rehire everybody on December 31st. Really, it's a non-starter. It doesn't really apply to us, but it's in the language there. And most importantly, you don't have to wait until December 31st to apply for forgiveness. So you can elect that 24-week period, that 24-week covered period, and you can apply before the end of the 24 weeks is up, and you don't have to wait out until December 31st to restore to get your FTEs back. You could do that at the last day when you end your covered period. So you have some flexibility. There's some nuances there, but you have flexibility. So the question is, well, why is that important? And the reason why that is important is because the way the application works is based on the costs that you incur over the covered period. So if you think back to when you applied for the loan, you applied for a loan that was based on the equivalent of 2.5 months of your payroll expense in 2019. So when you look at what that should cover, in theory, that should cover, and it was meant to cover 2 months of payroll and then to cover the non-payroll costs of rent and largely utilities and some interest. So that was kind of the theory behind the loan. Well, when we get into now the covered period, the 24 weeks becomes handy because if we don't have 100%, if we have a reduction in employment, so if our FTE count, which is that full-time equivalency count, if that is not 100%, that's going to drive a reduction in our potential forgiveness. By having 24 weeks, we're now able to stack additional weeks of payroll cost on top of each other. And so we can move high enough that even if we have significant reduction in employees, we in theory would still be able to achieve full forgiveness. So let me give you just a verbal example in that. If you had $1 million loan that you took out, but you terminated 50% of your employees and you didn't bring them back, over the 8-week period, it would only be possible for you to achieve 50% forgiveness. That's where you would be at. However, because now we have a 24-week period, we essentially have three times the amount of time for us to stack these costs. So just to keep the numbers very simple, instead of incurring $1 million of expense over this 24-week period, we would have $3 million. So just simple math, if we said, hey, $3 million has now been incurred, we have a 50% reduction, that would still get us to $1.5 million. And assuming that our 60-40 mix of payroll versus non-payroll is correct, we would still exceed the original loan amount. So we would still get full forgiveness. So that's just a real simple example as to why this 24-week period is important, because it allows you, even in extreme examples where you've had significant FTE reduction, still can achieve full forgiveness. So speaking of when you could apply for that forgiveness, the cleanest way would be to wait till the end of your 24 weeks. However, you can submit a loan forgiveness application before the end of that covered period. So if you got 12 weeks down the road and you did your calculations and you decided you were done, you in theory could draw the line, say this is the end of our covered period, and we want to go ahead and submit our application. However, as we just discussed, most of the lenders are not accepting applications right now anyways. And so even if you draw the line and you decide that you want to end early, you're not going to be able to submit the application. As we note on here, that can be important because you have two pieces of forgiveness reduction on this loan. The FTE, and I'll keep using that. I'm assuming everybody's familiar with that term, but full-time equivalent, the number of employees that you have during the covered period versus your baseline comparisons, which was a period in 2019 and a period in 2020. I won't get into the details of that calculation, but if you're not familiar with that calculation, that is a bad sign because that is a very basic building block for this. And so you have work to do to make sure you know what those numbers are. But that FTE reduction is of primary importance. But another piece that's important is a salary reduction. And so the way the code has been written is saying that if you have more than a 25% reduction in salary or the hourly rate of an employee, that amount has to be considered as a reduction of your forgivable amount. So just a very simple example, if you had somebody who was earning $2,000 a week, actually, let's just say they were earning $1,500 a week, keep them under $100,000. So if you are earning $1,500 a week, but during the covered period, you were only getting paid $500 a week, well, you would have $1,000 per week reduction there that would exceed 25% of your 1500. So you would have to, factor that into your forgiveness reduction. If you apply early, the nuance here is it requires you to do the math and you have to extend that out over the full 24 weeks. So even if you were to call it at 12 weeks, you would have to then extrapolate out any salary reductions that are calculating in your formula out over the full 24 weeks. I haven't seen any examples of that where it's even mattered from the forgiveness standpoint, because most of these covered periods now are allowing you to so far exceed your loan amount that it doesn't matter. But it's just a nuance that you have to think about when you're doing your calculations. So just thinking about some of the qualified expense requirements. So again, previous guidance was 75% had to be payroll costs. The new guidance now says it only has to be 60% of the loan amount has to be used for payroll costs. So that really wasn't geared towards our industry. That was more geared towards the restaurant industry that might be more capital intensive than they would be employee and labor intensive. But it's a benefit for us just from the standpoint of it gives us more flexibility. So if we were a dealership that did dramatically reduce our headcount and did not restore it, this gives us more movement here and gives us the allowance to allocate more expenses if we have to things like rent and interest and utilities. So there's more flexibility. Again, most of the dealerships that I'm working with are having no issue meeting that the 60% requirement. And I'm guessing most of you, as you look over your covered period, that's probably not an issue for you either when you're doing these calculations. Okay, this full-time equivalent rehire guidelines. So I kind of touched on this a few minutes ago, but this is super important. Because what this did was, to me, like, again, just another example of why the government was basically bending over backwards to make this loan forgivable and to make it a grant. This one right here is proof positive of that. And so what they did was, is they gave a safe harbor exemption for your FTE count during the covered period. So before this, they would have said, if you had 20 employees and you had to you furloughed 10, and you would be at 50%. If you can't bring back those other 10, you're at 50%. What they said now is if you tried to bring back those 10 individuals and you meet one of these requirements, that reduction wouldn't count against you. So your FTE count would still be 20. Now, from a math standpoint, if you're listening to that, you're going, okay, yeah, but we still only have 10 people. And so our payroll costs are going to be lower. Well, that's another reason why the 60-40 split was beneficial, because now even if you had lower payroll costs, your split between payroll and non-payroll expenses is better. The 24 weeks is better because now you have 24 weeks of those 10 people, so you can build up the expense. But these provisions here are super important. And so you can see the exceptions here. And so this is what is the first one is an inability to rehire individuals who were employees of the eligible recipient on February 15th. So they had to have been employed as of February 15th. And the inability to hire similarly qualified employees for unfilled positions on or before December 31st, 2020. So what it's saying here is if you can't bring people back that were on staff and you can't hire other people because other unemployment benefits and other things, or just fear of coming back to work, you're not going to need to be harmed with your FTE count. Or they give you another option here, which just says that you're able to document an inability to return to the same level of business activity. For us in the dealership space, that caveat doesn't work from a restaurant standpoint, bars, gyms, that type of thing, totally applicable. For us, that would be a very difficult argument to make. But what you can see is you have a safe harbor here. So if you found yourself in a situation where you truly couldn't get people to come back and you haven't been able to hire others, you could take this safe harbor. Most of my experience has been that we've been able to hire other people if we've had to. So I haven't seen too many examples of where we just absolutely couldn't get people to come back and we couldn't hire people for equivalent positions. But if that's the case, document it. And that's really the key here is just documenting that you went through this process and you couldn't, and you tried, and here's how you tried, and you have it documented. That's just a constant theme that we really hit on this is when you're building your PPP loan file, that you document all these decisions and you support why you made those decisions. Because if and when someone came to look at it within the 5-year period that they could, you want to have all that memorialized so you don't have to think back. You can just open it up and say, yep, here's what it was and here's the support. And that's also support that when your forgiveness application gets reviewed, that the lender and or the SBA might be looking at as well. Okay, so some deadlines and payment deferral dates. This is extremely important from the standpoint of just thinking about, okay, you know, great, what does it mean? We have our loan, we're going to seek forgiveness, but how long do we have to seek forgiveness for the loan? Flexibility Act really widened the window here and made it possible that says you have 10 months from the end of your covered period. So just for example, if you have a 24-week covered period, you have 10 months from the end of that 24 weeks to actually apply for forgiveness. That's important because what that tells you is if you want to push this out into 2021, you have that option very easily in front of you now. And I'll show you an example as to why you might want to do that based on the current tax law. Lenders have 60 days to make a forgiveness determination. And then it goes to the SBA, and the SBA has 90 days to make a forgiveness determination. So, I mean, this is almost comical because if you think about it, lenders have 2 months, and then the SBA has basically 3 months. So we're talking like there could be a 5-month gap between the day you submit your application and the day you actually hear that, yes, you have been absolved of your debt by the powers that be. So you can see how this is probably going to go on for a while. And so I think that's a really important bullet point just to kind of have highlighted. And just, you know, if your dealer principal is super eager to get this forgiven and I want to get it done, and I don't want to be, you know, I want to be done and I want to wash my hands of this. I hear that a lot. And the reality is it ain't going to happen. The banks aren't ready. And when they are, they have 60 days, and the SBA definitely isn't ready. And it has 90 days. So, that's something to keep in mind, along with this concept that someone could come back within 5 years and look at this file from the government if they so chose. So there really is no such thing as just wash my hands, get forgiven, and move on with life. Even if you finally get the forgiveness, which you most likely will, it still is not buried and never coming back up again. It absolutely could. And so, you know, just kind of an important comment here as well. You actually have that 10 months. During that 10 months, you're actually not required to make principal or interest payments as well. That was part of this saying that they would give you the 10-month period and you would have that waiver. So the terms are just, they were already generous. They were made extremely generous. Another example of that is if you did have a non-forgivable portion of this, which again, it's very difficult to conceive how that's possible in a dealership environment. But if the loan was made after June 5th, it's an automatic 5-year term now from a loan payback standpoint. If you have loans made prior to June 5th, it's 2 years. However, the lender can agree to extend that to 5, and most of them have that I've experienced in the dealership space. So that really hasn't been a problem. That's really not a big deal from the standpoint of most of us expect to get these forgiven. So really for that, that's more of a practical practical issue, I think, for us from a financial reporting standpoint. And we'll talk about that here in a few slides. But just thinking about, well, how do we record these on our balance sheet? What are they going to look like at December 31 at year end if they still haven't been forgiven? Is it long-term debt? Is there a current portion of long-term debt? What does that look like? And so, you know, knowing that we could have a 5-year payback amortization period can be helpful because if we have to make that decision as to how we properly report it from a financial statement standpoint, it just gives us a little bit more leeway there, makes it less onerous. Payroll tax deferral is included in the Flexibility Act. And all this is for our purposes is, you know, the idea that you could delay payment of employer tax. So again, delay, defer, not absolve. So just want to make sure we're clear. This isn't where you don't have to pay them. You just don't have to pay them as frequently. And you can delay 50% to 12/31/21 and 50% 12/31/2022. From a cash flow standpoint, most of us on this call probably don't have significant cash flow issues today. So this maybe not be as front of mind. You know, before, if you took a PPP loan, once forgiveness was granted, you were disallowed the deferral. However, now they've said even with forgiveness being granted, you can still do this deferral. So, you know, you might look at this. This could be a strategy if you're trying to maximize cash flow. You could do this. Again, I don't think this is significant enough for us in the dealership space where we would need to do this, but it's an option that's available to us. So just some nuances to the 24-week compensation covered period. You know, if you were looking at this originally under the 8-week period, the maximum amounts, you know, it's this concept of what's $100,000 annualized per employee. So the maximum amount of forgiveness we could get for any one employee was $15,385 for the 8-week period. You guys are better at the math than I am. So you know that if you do the 24-week period, 24/52nds of 100,000 is going to get you the $46,154. So that's the maximum amount for any one employee that you could seek forgiveness for. So just, you know, when you're looking at those calculations and you're looking at your employees, you just have to be cognizant of the fact that as you start to run to those 24 weeks, the employees that are your highly compensated employees over $100,000, California, maybe that's not the definition of highly compensated, but let's just say those over 100,000. Once you hit that cap, you're not going to be able to get any more forgiveness for them. So if you're looking to accumulate your payroll costs as you go over time, you got to be cognizant that you're capping those people at that, you know, the annualization at 100,000. Because what could happen is if you're not doing that, you may think, oh, we've accumulated, you know, more than enough for forgiveness. But then when you go back and you cap those for annualizing for $100,000, you find that, oh, those aren't eligible, so we have to reduce it. So just something to keep in mind. The last thing here, which is important, again, just for our, you know, this is only going to affect one individual or maybe two at the most, but these would be our employee owner compensation. So the owners of the dealership, if they are on the payroll as well, then you're only going to be able to take $20,833 for the 24-week period. The basis for that was the SBA was careful to say we don't want to allow owners of the company to take an outsized amount of forgiveness. That wasn't the intent of the program. The intent of the program was to keep people employed, not to keep owners' cash flow moving along. So that's why they capped it at that. So, you know, if you're in a dealership that's an S corporation and you have the dealer slash owner is receiving a wage from the company, then this would be something you'd want to be paying attention to, making sure that you're capping them at $20,833 for the 24-week period. Previously, they were with employees at $15,385 for the 8-week period. So that's just a nuance. If your dealership is a partnership, if it's an LLC and the dealer, the owner is on the payroll, that's a whole separate problem that shouldn't exist. So that's a separate issue that you want to talk to your accountants about, because they should not be receiving a W-2 if they are a member of the partnership. Just some nuances here on the owner forgiveness. It's kind of weird how they let you classify like health insurance premiums and retirement contributions. And you can see like it's, you know, for health insurance premiums, yes, if it's a C corp, but no, if it's a sole proprietorship, partners are S corps. Retirement, it's C and S corps are okay, but partnerships are not. So, you know, this was important before because, you know, some people were trying to scrape together all the costs they possibly could in the 8 weeks. Now with the 24 weeks that you most of you have so much payroll that's going to blast past whatever your loan amount was that I don't think this is a big deal, but I will refer you to the FAQs that were released August 4th. It goes into more detail on this and gives you a little bit more understanding if you want to determine, what should be classified. You know, determining who's an owner has been kind of a challenge. You know, what's that difference between 100% ownership versus 1%? Are they both equally owners? And unfortunately, the answer, it appears, is yes. It appears that there is, in the FAQs that came out on August 4th, we'll look at that here in a few minutes, there's some clarification there, but it's still, there's still some ambiguity here. You know, if somebody was an employee in 2019, but an owner in 2020, what does that mean? You know, how do you, you know, you received a loan based on their compensation in 2019, but now you're going to be subject to the ownership rules in 2020. So that's something to keep in mind if that was to be the case. Or if you had a new owner in 2020, unfortunately, based on the limited guidance, it would appear that, you know, likely they're not, that compensation is not eligible for forgiveness. But again, you should have enough stacking that it shouldn't be a problem. So I don't anticipate that that would be a major issue. 3508EZ, which is the EZ application form. So I love the way they give these acronyms. It's easy. And so there's three categories here. And the second bullet point here is the only one that with anybody I've worked with, I've had one company that fell into this where they did not reduce salaries or wages more than 25% and did not reduce the FTE count. And so they were eligible for this EZ application. Really, the only difference that you see with this EZ application is that you don't have to submit Table A, which you'll see if you look at the SBA application for forgiveness. Table A is where you have to list out all of your employees, and you have to bifurcate between those over 100,000, those below 100,000 based on your 2019 data, and you have to show their FTE equivalency in the data that comes out. That's the only difference, is you don't submit that. So it's really not that big of a deal, this EZ application, in my opinion, because the reality is you still have to have all of that data saved and stored and available for review upon the asking by the lender and by the SBA. So the only difference is instead of handing it over with the application, you are keeping it on file and hoping that no one ever calls you and says, we're here from the government and here to help, and we'd like to see what you have to show us. That being said, I guess the theory is that those easy applications should be automatic approvals, because essentially you're signing and certifying that it's correct. So I think they're taking your word at it. And so it should, in theory, make the forgiveness, it should make the forgiveness process maybe a little bit faster. Okay, so let's talk about some tax impacts quickly. So this is kind of a rub, and you may have heard about this, but the CARES Act specifically stated that the forgiveness of the loan would not be taxable income for federal tax purposes. And that's true, it's not. However, Treasury came along and issued guidance saying that, yeah, that's fine, but unfortunately, the expenses that are related to it, well, they are not eligible as deductions. And so essentially by doing that, it makes the forgiveness taxable. So Congress intended for you to receive money that would be tax-free. Treasury, who writes the rules, Congress makes the laws, and then Treasury interprets the law and writes the rule. Treasury said, no, that's not the case. And unfortunately, that is what it is. So, at the end of the day, we still sit here mid-August and Congress has not fixed this. It doesn't appear that they're going to fix this. There's been talk that they would adjust this and that we would see this taken care of. So it's entirely possible between now and the end of the year that this gets fixed, but it hasn't happened yet. Just to give you an example, like what does this look like? Just to kind of, visually, I know a lot of us are visual here and we look at numbers all day. So, but all you're seeing here on the left-hand side is your book income. And then if you look on the right-hand side is your taxable income. And so you can see where book income, our total income for book is 52,500,000. If we go to the right, it's only 50 million for taxable because the PPP loan has been removed. And so that's not taxable income. But unfortunately, we go below the line and we look at our expenses and we can see where they're removing our payroll expense, our rent expense, and our utilities expense deduction. And so at the end of the day, our expenses for GAAP are higher than they are for taxable purposes. So at the end of the day, we get to the exact same net income, taxable income number of 12,500,000. So this is why I was mentioning that, there might be some wisdom in determining that you will wait to seek forgiveness until 2021. Because in theory, if you haven't received forgiveness as of 12/31, I guess the argument can be made that you would not have the related income and you would also not have the removal of these deductions. So you would have had access to this cash flow, but not having had to pay tax on it. That's a gray area. There still hasn't been any ruling on that, and there's still discussion as to what that looks like. So I wouldn't say that it's set in stone and just, hey, we're going to do this and it's going to work out. Wait and see. But this is another reason as to why it may not make sense to rush to forgiveness right now. So again, thinking about the dealer principal who may be very eager to get forgiveness as soon as possible, there are some reasons why it might make sense not to. And this could be one where you could have a delta here where you're able to, again, you have the cash flow, you don't have tax, you're able to use it, and you don't, so you benefit yourself in 2020. Obviously 2021, it's going to unwind. That could all be a non-issue because if Congress fixes this before the end of the year or right at the beginning of 2021, they may fix this and remove this deduction piece for the expense lines. And that would fix the issue. And then we wouldn't have tax. From a practical standpoint, this is just an important thing to keep in mind for the owners of the dealership that, hey, you know, if the PPP loan remains as it is now, is taxable, from an estimated tax payment standpoint, they need to keep that in mind. Like that's money they're going to have to pay tax on. So having tax, you know, distributions commensurate with their tax liability to account for the additional PPP money is going to be important. And just from a planning standpoint, from a cash flow standpoint, is something that you're going to want to keep in mind. And so that's why, you know, here I just say, hey, look, impact on 2020 estimates, you know, it's going to be important because, you know, if this doesn't get fixed, you're going to have additional tax liability. You know, the good news is we got the cash. We've been able to use it. It was free money, so to speak. Of course, we know nothing's free, but it was free as free can be. We've had use of it. So it's still not all bad, but it may not be as good as advertised. Who would have thought that would happen with our government? Not me. Okay. This is the least exciting part of this, but just talking about you know, your financial statement, what is it supposed to look like? And I know each of the manufacturers have issued guidance. They have all, you know, said where they want to see these, what line items do they want to see them on in the dealer financial statement. So, you know, I think this is really straightforward. What you're finding, though, is there are some entities that are deciding, hey, we want to record this as a grant. We don't want to record this as a loan for now. We're just going to consider it a grant. From a GAAP standpoint, if you have an audited or reviewed financial statement, that's a little bit of a problem because grant, you know, the accounting rules over grants are very strict, and they have rules that you have to follow in order to consider something a grant. So we have some clients that maybe are in the not-for-profit space or in the healthcare space that they receive a significant amount of government grants. And so for them to classify it as a grant, they have a little bit more leeway, and it makes sense in certain situations. For dealerships, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. I think we keep it as a loan on our balance sheet. And once we receive forgiveness, it goes down into other income, which is largely consistent with all the manufacturers' accounting guidance because they want to keep that segregated. We don't want to distort our dealer financial statements. And so just kind of thinking about that, another thing that I just keep repeating, I have some clients who say, hey, I want to start taking some of this into income on a monthly basis. And I keep hitting the brakes and saying, do not do anything to make the dealer financial statement look any better than it really is, because the manufacturer needs to see, they need to understand the pain felt pre-PPP loan. Like, let's not distort that. And so, if you're getting pressure to take this into income or, you know, move it around, you really resist that because there's no benefit in showing a better financial statement to the manufacturer. You know, I understand if you have covenants and you have things that you're worried about, but, you know, if you show the manufacturer anything better than actual reality, you're not doing yourself a service later on, because they obviously will come back and say, hey, it wasn't that bad. And you go, yeah, it was. And they say, well, but your financial statement. So, one thing, you know, in debt covenants, I would just say, if you have any other covenants, you know, we have our standard working capital and effective net worth requirements for certain manufacturers. But if you have other debt covenants, that if you have a third party lender or whatever, I would just say, just be careful and cognizant of how you're classifying this. Okay. So we talked about the 8-week period versus the 24-week period. And so, you know, just, you know, a couple, just some ideas. You know, some people that, you know, they stuck with the 8-week period, they wanted to be done, they used the money, they were able to get full forgiveness. And so in those circumstances, when you can calculate full forgiveness, you know, yeah, it probably makes sense. Stick with the 8-week period. Again, this is assuming you got your loan before June 5th. And you're eligible for this. But, you know, you can apply, in theory, you could apply for forgiveness now. You could be done. You don't have to worry about the uncertainty as to what's going to happen in the future. That makes sense. The 24-week period, though, as we talked about, it literally makes it almost impossible not to get full forgiveness. I mean, it's very difficult to see many scenarios where you won't get full forgiveness based on a 24-week period. It's just, it's there. So, you know, that to me is the biggest thing. The other play you might hear is that some people would say, well, we don't want to be the first one that the SBA looks at. And that's probably true. You know, I don't know if you remember back many years ago when you would fly and after 9/11 and the TSA was formed. And if you were the first person to get on the plane, they would have the guy there that was pulling people to the side. And without fail, they always pulled the first person. And so you wanted to be the second person. And so there might be some wisdom in that, not being the first. But, you know, I think it's important to remember that the lenders are going to look at it first before it even gets filtered over to the SBA. And the SBA is woefully understaffed to handle this. Stat that I didn't put in the slide deck, but the SBA processed more loans in 14 days than they processed in almost 5 years when this program came online. So it just puts it into perspective the volume of what they were dealing with, and it puts it into perspective the size of that agency is not big enough to keep up with the review of all of these forgiveness applications. So I think it just highlights another reason why that 5-year window where they have the ability to come back and look. And the reason why they have that is because they've required you to keep your documentation. So it just highlights the risk that I think still exists, where some point down the road, there could be a political move where somebody says, hey, I want to take another look at all those loans that were forgiven. So you just never know. And that's why it's so important to make sure your documentation is good. And that you have it concise and that it memorializes, because memories are short and we all kind of forget kind of what we did or why we did it or how we did it. So having that all concise and available so you can hand to someone is going to be extremely helpful. So again, you know, using the shorter, you know, we mentioned that the 24-week period, you don't have to wait till the end of the 24 weeks. You could use a period between 8 weeks and 24. So if you got to 12 weeks, you could decide that, hey, we're ready to go and we're going to submit our application. So there's flexibility. That's a nice thing. However, as we mentioned, if you had a salary and wage reduction that was occurring through that 12 weeks that you calculated, you'd have to extrapolate that out over an additional 12 weeks to get you to 24. Probably not a big deal, because you should have enough cost accumulated at that point. But you would have to make sure you do that calculation. One thing that is still a little bit less clear, and it is somewhat defined in the FAQs in August, but you know, your average FTE end date, they did really define that very well. In a practical standpoint, what is happening in practice is the FTE end date is the date that you're drawing as the end of your covered period. So that's the practical move. Okay, so we talked about loans in excess of $2 million, that original slide where I think it was 0.7% of all loans were over $2 million. So if you're in the over $2 million category, this was, you know, early on, this is where they came out and they talked about they're going to automatically audit loans in excess of $2 million. What does that mean? I don't know. What does it mean for the SBA to audit a loan? I don't know. Nobody knows. What does that mean for them? What does audit mean to them? How do they define an audit? We don't know. It's not the IRS. So it's part of Treasury. It's governed by Treasury, but it's not the IRS. So we don't know what they're going to do to audit. Is it somebody who has experience and understands loans well enough to properly audit them? Probably not, based on the volume. So it's going to be interesting to see what does that mean. So if you have a loan over $2 million, the takeaway there is, you gotta have your documentation really, really concise. And so, you know, even if you're under $2 million, I would still want to have concise documentation, because you just never know. But over $2 million, it's going to get looked at, you know, it's going to get scrutinized. And so just making sure, that we've documented our economic uncertainty when we applied for the loan, that we put our facts and circumstances around when we applied for the loan, which was likely at the end of March. What did economic uncertainty look like? You know, printing out, you know, whether you print something out from the LA Times or you save articles from CNBC, or just having that period of time memorialized, because again, even as we sit here in the middle of August, it's hard to remember how scary March was, because we've moved so far away from it. So imagine how hard it'll be to remember it a year from now, when who knows what'll be going on. So it's, you know, if you follow the stock market, the S&P 500 hit a record high yesterday. It's hard to believe that happened when back on March 23rd, it was at 2200 approximately. And the analysts were saying S&P was going to go to 1800, and here now we're at a record high. So, memorializing why you had economic uncertainty, why you applied for the loan, and then making sure all your payroll data is concise, making sure your non-payroll costs are properly documented, and having one nice, neat package is certainly going to be helpful. And again, I just can't emphasize enough, economic uncertainty was at the date you signed the application for the loan. Economic uncertainty is not today. It's not the day that somebody audits it. It's not sometime in the middle. Economic uncertainty was when you applied for the loan. So that's why making sure that point in time is properly documented. So public information disclosure is an interesting piece of this. So if you weren't aware, it is public information. The Treasury was actually trying to be quite restrictive at first. And then there was quite a bit of political pressure on them to be more transparent as to who got a loan. And so you can see here, if you're under 150,000, the data disclosed was pretty minimal, but over 150,000, the business name and the address was released. And, you know, this was a big deal when people were applying for the loans too, just because from the standpoint of, if you took a loan and you didn't hire everybody back, are you a pariah in the neighborhood now? Because everybody's going to know you, hey, ABC Motors took the loan and they still fired 50% of their people. What's up with that? I think we've moved past that. I don't think in today's environment, I don't think that's as big of an issue, but you could see how that someone could use that as a political weapon down the road. So it's just something to keep in mind and to make sure that you're aware and the dealer principal is aware that, hey, this information's out there. Everybody can see it, and someone will probably use it for purposes less than good. Okay. Let me stop sharing here. Come back to you. So I couldn't see anybody while I was doing that. But the good thing is there's only two of you with your pictures on. So that makes it, I wasn't missing anything. And yeah, Ruth, hello. It's good to see you. Okay, I'm going to pull up, I'm going to share my screen again. And I'm going to pull up the FAQs.
So one of the questions was, can we get this slideshow?
Yes. So I'll send you the slideshow. And then I'll send the FAQs as well, which are, those are available online, but I'll send them just so that people don't have to hunt for those.
Okay.
Is there any other question before we jump into these FAQs really quick?
Two other questions.
Yeah. Let's do some questions.
Yeah. One is there a percentage of ownership for this cap? And I think you answered that. It was 100% to 1%.
Yeah, let's.
The first was answered. Oh, they said that we answered the first. Okay.
Yeah.
Second question they have is, does a reduction apply to commission employees whom we did not cut their percentages? We just had less business. So their commissions were less than 25% than their averages.
Yeah. So we'll look at the FAQs here that kind of speaks to that, where it talks of salary and wage. Commission is difficult because, in theory, and this is going to be more of the gospel according to Lewis than it is the SBA, but, you know, in theory, a commissioned employee is basically a minimum wage employee. You know, I have seen some positions taken that has said, okay, look, minimum wage is our base. That's our base pay. Anything earned over that is a result of commissions earned. And so if we're looking at base to base, that's what we would do. Now, the problem with that is when you calculated your loan, you from 2019, you used their full comp. You didn't just use a base comp. So you've already calculated a loan based on a commissioned influenced amount. And then when you look at their Q1 2020, that 13-week period is where you got to look at in order to establish your base, what I keep referring to as your baseline compensation for your comparison. You know, what are you using in that one? Well, you're probably not using a minimum wage calc. You're using the commissions included. So that is commissions are a challenge. There's no doubt about it. And so you could say, well, do we fall into the safe harbor then? Or do we have a safe harbor because, they don't count as an FTE reduction, and then therefore the salary reduction doesn't count because we couldn't restore business to our previous volume. You know, I mean, I guess you could make that argument. I think that's a really hard argument to make in the dealership space. By and large, not everywhere, but most places in California, they've been able to come back. LA County is very difficult, but even in LA County, many of the dealerships there have been able to come back. So I don't know. It's a good question. And we're not going to know until you submit forgiveness applications. That's unfortunately the case in this, because we have absolutely zero examples of what's happened when people have applied. Are there any other questions? Like, if anybody has any questions they want to verbalize, you want to come off mute, I'm happy to take a few questions.
Only problem with unmuting is we had a lot of feedback. So if somebody wants to ask a question and not type a question, if they'll put in the chat that they want me to unmute them, I will unmute them, because then you get a lot of feedback. And then,
we don't want feedback. Well, and I literally don't want feedback if it's bad. So, you know, I don't want feedback or profanity, if anybody has any profanity to throw my way. So, okay, well, let's look at the frequently asked questions really quick then, because it's starting to get late. And let me just scroll up. So these are the FAQs, and they've issued several iterations of these. So if you go back on the SBA website, you'll see that these, continue to get issued. And let's make sure, you can see this on your screen?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So you can see the top here. These are the ones as of August 4th. So we know that these are the most recent. This was actually probably one of the most helpful set of FAQs they released, because there was some very direct information in here. So I'm just going to highlight some of these FAQs just as, you know, I would encourage you, if you haven't looked at this, read through this, because this answers a lot of questions. Things as simple as here on page one, which talks about the submission of a timely loan forgiveness application. We talked about, do you have to make any payments on the loan prior to the SBA remitting the forgiveness amount? And so this goes through and talks about, no, you're not going to have to. And it gives you the details as to why that is. Again, just another example of how they made this program as friendly as possible. It went from being very onerous to like, we're going to do everything we can to make sure you don't have to pay any of this money back. And it makes sense. I totally get it. They want the money in the economy. And so if you as the business owner have to pay this money back, that's money that you can't use to employ people, that you can't use to buy things with. So it makes sense why they want this money, in the economy. Page three, question number five here. This one's, I think, is really good. Let me see if I can highlight this. Yeah. So this is somewhat similar to what we were just talking about, but are only salaries or wages covered by loan forgiveness, or can a borrower pay lost tips, lost commissions, bonuses, or other forms of incentive pay, and have such costs qualify for loan forgiveness? And the answer is yes. And so the piece I didn't answer about that commission question, this is what's interesting. So you might say, well, I could pay these people a bonus, and I could say, hey, look, if I'm falling below the 25%, I could proactively pay those people a bonus, even if it's a one-time bonus, and that would get me over the 25% threshold there, and I don't have a reduction. But you might also say, well, I don't want to do that because I have enough non-payroll costs that I'm going to get covered, so I don't want to – that's just going to be money out of my pocket at the end of the day. So you have flexibility there. You could do that if, depending on what your facts and circumstances are, it might make sense. It might make sense to do that, but you'd have to look at your facts and circumstances. Page four here, this one is important. When we were talking about owner compensation, these are the updated rules here for owner's compensation. And so we talked about some of these in the slides, but you could look through number eight here, and this is going to give you examples for C corporations, which won't be very many of us, S corporations, which might be more of us, and then partnerships is loosely defined down below, but you can see the additional information that exists there. Let's go down to page 6. Let's see. So this is one that that we didn't talk about in the slides, but I just wanted to mention is, and it asks about non-payroll costs incurred during the covered period, but paid after the covered period. And so that seems to be a commonly asked question. Do I have to make the payments on the last day? And the answer is no. You don't have to. So you don't have to run a special, you know, check run or whatever to pay for rent and to pay for utilities and interest. You just have to make those payments before the next regular billing date. So, you know, as long as you would pay them in the normal course of business, like you would, you're going to be fine. So that's just an administrative question that, you know, we just didn't know. And so we have clarity. Page 7, number 4, this one is interesting from the standpoint of, it doesn't say it, but in a roundabout way, it addresses the question we've had on, would floor plan interest be an allowable interest item, a non-payroll expense that could be deducted? And based on this wording, it makes it pretty clear that floor plan interest should be included. And the reason why is because it says payments of interest on business mortgages on real or personal property, such as an auto loan, are eligible for loan forgiveness. So I don't think they meant this when they said such as an auto loan. I think what they meant was a traditional retail loan on a vehicle that a business might be leasing or financing. Tax standpoint, uh-oh, that makes sense is when they talk about a business mortgage on real or personal property. And so that counts. Your vehicle inventory, your fleet is not your fleet, but your vehicle inventory available for sale with the floor plan financing, it fits under this definition. So what I would say is I would include your floor plan interest as one of your items of non-payroll costs. Again, you probably have enough payroll costs, it doesn't matter. But I would include them. And ultimately, it's going to be up to the lender to interpret this and to reject or accept this. But I would expect there'll be consistency because of the size of our industry. And so this, to me, seems to answer our question as it relates to floor plan interest. So that's good, because that was something that was very vague and we didn't know the answer. Last question on here that I thought was interesting that I would just highlight as well. It's just for purposes of calculating the loan forgiveness reduction required for salary or hourly wage reductions in excess of 25% for certain employees. Are all forms of compensation included, or are only salaries and wages? So this doesn't get as specific as I would have been helpful. But what it does is it tells us, for purposes of calculating reductions in the loan forgiveness amount, the borrower should only take into account decreases in salaries or wages. So, you know, it doesn't use that word commission. And I think that's probably what most of us would have liked for it to say is, you know, how does this fit in here? But they come back to this concept of a salary or wage. And so, you know, I think if you find yourself in a situation where you have a lot of commission people who have made less money and you're falling short and it's going to harm you, you might want to go back and just truly understand what defines a salary and a wage, and to make sure you're comparing apples to apples from the baseline to the covered period. And maybe you take that position. If you find yourself in a situation where even with that salary reduction, you're still in excess of your forgiveness or you're still in excess of the loan, and so you're going to get full forgiveness, I probably wouldn't waste your time trying to needle that. Again, it's all about if you're far enough ahead of the game, which you should be with 24 weeks, it should be a non-issue. Okay. So I will, I'll definitely, I'll send both of these so you can distribute these and make sure everybody has these. So
we did get two more questions.
Perfect.
One question was, we have dealer trade drivers who are on call. During this time, they have had fewer hours, but are at the same hourly rate.
Yeah. So if it's really about the hourly, that's a great question, because it's about the wage or the hourly rate, not about the number of hours. So if if you're looking at it, so you would already be penalized from an FTE standpoint. So for example, if you had those individuals that were on call and they were earning, they were doing approximately 20 hours a week during Q1 2020, they would have essentially counted as 0.5 of an FTE. If you have them now in the covered period and they're only doing, I don't know, 5 hours a week, whatever, the math's not exact, but now they would only be a 0.1 FTE. So you're going to get FTE reduction with that example. You wouldn't be then required to take a wage reduction as well. You're not going to get hit twice. So that's how they would look at it, because the hours have gone down. The FTE equivalency has gone down as well.
Okay. And then the next question is about FTE. Since we want to wait until next year to apply for tax reasons, would it be safe to say, make sure you restore your headcount by 12/30/20. Will this prove the restoring FTE be for payroll registers, which include this day?
So the way the answer is yes. The last day you have to restore full employment would be 12/31. So you would need to make sure that those people were rehired as of 12/31. I mean, that's essentially the requirement. So if that's what you're going to do, again, I would just go back and just make sure you even need to do that, because if you're doing the 24-week period, it's more likely than not. I mean, again, I think the most drastic example I've had is a dealership that pretty much reduced their count by almost 50%. We went down to 50%. And even at 50% over a 24-week period, they were still able to get full forgiveness. So I don't know. Now, if you just are just going to restore employment, if that's just what you're going to do anyways, well then yeah, go ahead and do it by 12/31. But if you're just doing it for forgiveness purposes, it may not be necessary. So just going through that calculation, I think, would make a lot of sense before you go through the brain damage of potentially bringing back people that you wouldn't otherwise bring back.
Okay. Any more questions? All right.
I guess the last thing I would say is we didn't go into spreadsheets tonight. We didn't go into like the math of how your support should look. I mean, that's a whole separate issue. Another topic for another time maybe, but just making sure that you're using a good spreadsheet and that you're using something that is accurately tracking. It is really hard in the dealership space because we don't follow the typical payroll period. So, if you have, we pay on the 5th and the 20th, and then we have a washout on the 10th. Most of these tracking spreadsheets aren't built to handle our dealership type payroll. So it can be a challenge as to how we track our FTE count, because we look at the hours because we have to track that, but we don't skew those because we have a wash period on the 10th. I would just remind you that, there's a lot of resources out there, but just remember, because of the nuances of the space with our commissioned employees, with our wash periods, it just makes it just a little bit more difficult for us.
Okay. Somebody's asking if you have a sample spreadsheet that you can share.
And I do not, unfortunately. So different firms have taken different positions. We have a full PPP team that does this. I've done some, we have a group that is focused on this. And so we've taken the position that because of all the nuances, that we have arrangements where we take the data and we put it in our spreadsheets and produce it, versus just giving the spreadsheet and saying, go forth and live long and be happy. But I guarantee you, if you Google it, you will find many examples online. There's several firms that have given spreadsheets out, but I will caution you that they're not all very accurate. So, tread carefully. I don't know if NADA has produced a spreadsheet. I don't think they have. I know they've given a ton of guidance. NADA guidance is very good on this, by the way. So if you're looking for another touch point for guidance, NADA is extremely, extremely good in their suggestions. So that's a good place to go to if you're for guidance. But from a spreadsheet standpoint, that I don't have.
Okay. All right. So if there's no more questions before everybody signs off, Jennifer is going to take her 5 minutes as the Platinum Sponsor of the Month from Scully Rasmussen. I'd like to thank you, Lewis, for presenting to us. I appreciate it. And I'll look forward for the email, and I'll make sure everybody gets a copy of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Jennifer.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. I'm sorry about what happened earlier. It's a long story, but I'm internet challenged right now. I'll just start from the beginning again. And it's, you know, because it's good to see you all here. And as the DOMA sponsors, you know, we get our firm gets a few minutes here to introduce ourselves to those of you who don't know who we are. Scully Rasmussen is a law firm that is pretty much full service for dealerships. We specialize in dealerships, and I specialize in employment law for dealerships. I'm having worked in dealership operations for 15 years in human resources and legal compliance. So just wanted to kind of maybe cover a few things that are going on right now that maybe I'm thinking I might want to ping you guys on from a legal compliance standpoint in these few minutes. For example, you remember several months ago, all we could talk about was the CCPA. And it's like, what? CCPA? What's that? It seems like it was so long ago we were all worried about it, but you know, it's still there. We have a CCPA program, a comprehensive program. There are policies you have to have in place and compliance measures you have to take that I just wanted to remind you about, because I know that is something that has not been top of mind these days. So let us know if we can assist you with that. Of course, our firm offers, multiple COVID compliance programs. Just remember, just because you're taking good precautions, such as sanitizing and installing plexiglass and doing physical distancing and, employee screening, a lot of employers don't realize that they're required to have an actual written policy and written process and a written risk assessment. If you're ever audited through a complaint, or if, God forbid, there's any litigation in the future by an employee or customer, the first thing that's going to be asked is, well, what are your written policies and your written where's your written risk assessment? And you just don't want to be caught flat-footed on that. So let us know if you need anything for that. We have our own COVID task force, and we have programs available on a flat fee basis. We've also provided multiple free COVID webinars and alerts and articles for our clients. Just the last thing I wanted to touch upon, as we get into the latter part of this year, something that's also been out of the spotlight is an upcoming deadline, which is mandatory harassment training for non-supervisors. This is something new that you haven't had to do in the past. Remember, previously only employers with 50 or more employees had to train supervisors and managers on harassment every 2 years. Now all employers with 5 or more employees have to provide 1 hour harassment training to non-supervisory employees. So this is a new thing, and the deadline to meet this requirement for the first time is January 1st, 2021. So you have basically until the end of the year. Getting all your employees trained is a much more daunting task than, just your supervisors, which you've had to do in the past, probably. So it'll be a longer, more involved process. And it's even more challenging now that you can't like cram all your non-supervisor employees into a room for this training. So, you can consider online training, for employees, you can have them do their own online, or you can do online training, or you can have something done live over Zoom or GoToWebinar, which our firm does, and I have done harassment training in that format, because the training has to be interactive. So
web training is not as good for meeting this requirement as some type of live, Zoom or go to webinar training, because employees can ask questions and there's instant feedback. So if you have 5 or more employees, don't forget about this requirement by the end of the year. And I think that's kind of all I wanted to cover, just to make sure, you know, things are top of mind that are coming up that I want to make sure you guys have thought about and have covered from a compliance standpoint. And if you need anything further from us, let us know. And that's it. And I hope you all have a good night.
Lynn, I can't hear you.
Okay, sorry about that. Okay, everybody. I was muted. Thanks for joining us. Our meeting next month is going to be also on the Wednesday, the third Wednesday of the month. KPA is going to be the speaker, and hope to see you guys all next month.
Awesome.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Lynn.